Got it. Here we go. Tom and Curly Show. Thanks, everybody, for tuning in. Here we go. You write to us at mynorthwest.com. Come on in that way. You can also text us the State Roofing text line 98973.
Coming in.
Yep. There he is. All righty. The president of the United States, the oldest guy we ever elected, and the man that is giving James Buchanan a run for his money, spoke at the UN, Tom, and he walked in there and he had a few things to say. He didn't really call out China or anybody. Remember when Donald Trump would speak at the UN? It was big, big news because you never knew what the guy was going to say.
Right.
He's like, oh my gosh. Remember when Trump didn't even know why he got a laugh, but he got a laugh the first time he addressed the UN because he said something about like he could handle all this or he's doing all this. And anyway, the president goes in there and talks about the problems starting at the UN. He says that
we stand, in my view, at an inflection point in history. And I'm here today to share with you how the United States intends to work with partners and allies to answer these questions.
Yep.
Instead of continuing to fight the wars of the past, we are fixing our eyes on devoting our resources to the challenges that hold the keys to our collective future. Ending this pandemic, addressing the climate crisis, managing the shifts in global power dynamics, shaping the rules of the world on vital issues like trade, cyber, and emerging technologies, and facing the threat of terrorism as it stands today.
Okay. Here's the end of his speech. It was basically just, you know, vanilla milk. I mean, there really wasn't much to it. Didn't call anybody out. Didn't say anything to China. Right. Nothing to Iran. Nothing to the people
who
wanted.
Words of reassurance. Yeah. That's what I think his goal was. Yeah. And it also might have been put.
Yeah. Trust me. You see how well we treated our allies in Afghanistan.
I stand here today.
You address that.
For the first time in 20 years, the United States not at war. We've turned the page. All the unmatched strength, energy, and commitment, will, and resources of our nation are now fully and squarely focused on what's ahead of us, not what was behind. I know this. As we look ahead, we will lead. We will lead on all the greatest challenges of our time, from COVID to climate, peace and security, human dignity and human rights, but we will not go it alone. We will lead together with our allies and partners and in cooperation with all those who believe, as we do, that this is within our power to meet these challenges, to build a future that lifts all of our people and preserves this planet. But none of this is inevitable. It's a choice. And I can tell you where America stands. We will choose to build a better future. We, you and I, we have the will and capacity to make it better. Ladies and gentlemen, we cannot afford to waste any more time. Let's get to work.
Okay.
Let's make our better future now. We can do this. It's within our power and capacity. Thank you. God bless you all.
Okay. It's like it's a campaign speech, it sounds like.
Yeah, it felt to me, the whole thing, it was sort of a tone setter. Mm-hmm. He didn't, light the world on fire rhetorically.
Never
or,
has.
You know, politically. No, I know. I think you're right. Yeah. I think he's just trying to establish that line, we will not go it alone. I think he's just trying to make a distinction. And yeah, it's boring, but it's like words of reassurance. Unlike Donald Trump, who is I alone can fix it, America mm-hmm. first kind of attitude. Yeah. I think he was saying we all can work together. The only people that he called out, in effect, were not individuals or individual countries. He just set up this basic battle between democracy and authoritarianism, and he thought that democracy is going to win out and should win out.
I mean, he didn't expect much more from him. He's not like Khrushchev is going to take his shoe off and pound on the thing, or Castro, who spoke for what, 3 hours or something like that, right? So he's a placeholder for the next person that comes along that is far whatever the next president is. This is the placeholder that we have in place because he ran on basically his campaign was vote for me. I'm not that other guy. and then vote for me because I've been around for a long time. And you know me. Although you don't really know me, you know I've been around for a long time. I'm Joe Biden. I approve this message. So people looked and said, well, he has been around a long time. And he is not that other guy, so let's get him. And this is what we get. So you get somebody like this. As I mentioned, James Buchanan, because Buchanan has seen by historians as being one of the most ineffective presidents and possibly therefore also the worst president at a very difficult time in our history. And then this could be the next. So he could possibly be second or first when historians probably take the
the measure not after of his Trump. Total. I think Trump has secured that space for a long time.
Really? How so, though, Tom?
Yes. Just because the way he sort of dismantled the way the world operated, that's why I think somebody bland. I think you're right. Biden is just sort of a reassuring force to the world that he's not just a bull in a china shop, as you often describe that Trump. And that's reassuring to people.
Well, he doesn't have the energy to be a bull in a china shop.
The well, maybe that's a good thing.
The populist nature of Donald Trump was people didn't want Hillary Clinton, which was going to be seen as the next another 4 years of Obama, which was, a stagnant economy, wages not rising, blaming everything on the other people.
John.
Right, Tom.
Under but they Obama. Didn't. But yeah, anyway.
But anyway, listen, so here's what we have, and here he is now. So there you go. The press pool, we just saw the story, has called out and have filed a formal complaint against the White House because they said when it comes to having people from other countries, other leaders, like there is Bojo sitting there with him, right? Boris Johnson sitting, and then the president sitting there. What normally happens is they get a chance to ask the question of the visiting dignitary, prime minister, president, whoever it is, and then they get a chance to ask a question of the president. And they ask the question of Boris Johnson, and then his team of female hectors start screaming, "That's it! Thank you! Thank you! Thank you! Thank you! Thank you! Thank you!" And the CBS pool has filed a formal complaint with the White House saying, "This is not how it works. If we get a chance to ask a question of Boris Johnson, we also get a chance to ask a question of the president. You can't keep hurrying us out. He's not in his basement anymore. We'd like to talk to him." And we'll see what the White House does on that.
Yeah, fine. And don't forget those ringing words, "Build back better." That also helped him get elected.
Mm-hmm. Whatever that meant. What does that mean, build back
better? Build back better.
Oh, okay, yes. I'm not Donald Trump. The governor who wanted to be president of the United States, and then he had to come back and be governor again, he's got some requests.
It is still a significant challenge happening all across our state.
Hospitals in Washington state are still over capacity, but doctors say the number of COVID patients hospitalized appears to be leveling off. They peaked September 9th when more than 1,700 people were hospitalized with COVID in our state.
By the way, just so you know, there's more than 10,000 hospital beds. Just putting that in perspective.
Now it sits closer to...
Unless you remember when they say have COVID, so you have COVID, but you might not be treated for COVID.
1,500. But hospital leaders want to be...
It does matter. Because the person's not going to be in there that long. Person might not be in there that long. It's the number of people in ICU, number of people on ventilators, people that are actually have COVID. It's a COVID thing.
Let's hear the report.
Clear.
Yes.
The leveling off COVID patients hospitalized appears to be leveling off.
Okay.
They peaked September 9th when more than 1,700 people were hospitalized with COVID in our state. Now it sits closer to 1,500. But hospital leaders want to be clear. The leveling off doesn't mean the patients went home.
One of the reasons the hospitalization rates are falling is that death rates are rising.
The situation is still so dire, Governor Jay Inslee sent this letter to the COVID response coordinator at the White House, asking the federal government to provide Washington State with medical staff resources. The Washington State Department of Health already asked FEMA for 1,200 clinical and non-clinical staff to help, and so far, they have not arrived. Hospitals in eastern Washington are being hit even harder.
We're still at our all-time highs since the start of this pandemic. And although we're not practicing crisis standards of care medicine on this side of the state, we still feel like we're in crisis.
Spokane is treating COVID patients from Idaho, which is so overwhelmed they have declared crisis standards of care and have to make tough decisions over who gets care and who doesn't. FEMA did send medical teams to northern Idaho earlier this month. Back in Washington, that hasn't happened. All the hospitals are working together to move patients around the state to get care. When it comes to a shortage, it isn't about space. It's about the doctors, nurses, and support staff available to care for patients. patients.
The amount of care that a sick COVID patient requires is just incredibly large.
So it's not about the number, it's about the staffing. That's doctors and nurses.
Yes.
Right. It's a staffing thing. It's not the number, it's the people.
Well,
there's not enough. They got the beds, but they don't have the people to actually.
Highest number of COVID hospitalizations as well. I don't know how significant that is, but that, considering we're 18 months into this thing, that's surprisingly high.
Mm.
So that's what we're asking for. We're asking for personnel at this point. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. So then the vaccine continues to clunk along. I had seen that at CenturyLink Field, they could vaccinate. Or was it CenturyLink? No. It was at the Puyallup Fair. Sorry, that's your tradition. The Washington State Fair. They have, last time we checked, about halfway through, 450,000 people had gone through. They don't normally give the full attendance until the whole fair is over, which I think comes up in a couple of days. I think it's like the 23rd or 26th. So out of 450,000 people that have gone through the fair, guess how many took advantage of the free vaccines, Tom?
1,000?
230.
Oh, only 230.
Only 230.
So does that mean that everybody else was vaccinated?
I don't know. Did you have to show something to get in? No, I don't think you had to. You had to wear the mask. I talked to somebody that went to the game on Sunday, and they told me that the person sitting there or standing there letting you in, you hold up your phone and you show them a picture of your vaccine card.
Yeah.
Right. You do not hold up your driver's license. And the person just went, okay, fine, on in. So what I would do is I'd take my vaccine card and I would send it to my friend Steve, and then Steve would have it, so then he would just hold it up. It's like sneaking into a bar in New Jersey back in the 80s.
I mean, you can cheat the system, but still, mostly people go to the trouble of having that done, and then they check it. You're right. You could get a COVID test, you know, not even be vaccinated, get a COVID test within 72 hours and give it to somebody else to go if you really want to sneak in like that. Doesn't seem worth it, but
if you want to go to the game and you don't want to get vaccinated, sure, you sneak in. I'm just saying the system is a facade of system.
It's not airtight, but it's more likely to be true than not in the majority of cases.
Right.
Now, will some people get through? I'm sure.
It's just more sort of the kabuki theater of concern.
I think most people probably are vaccinated.
Yeah, was it 70-some percent in King County, more than 70% in King County?
Yeah.
Yeah. All right, moving on to a story that I cannot even begin to wrap my mind around, but I can sort of understand if they say that the frontal cortex and the part of the brain that needs to connect doesn't connect in a human being. Until about the age of 24 to 26 years old. I know it's faster for a girl than it is for a boy, if you believe that they're actually separate genders. And this case is a 15-year-old girl driving down the road, apparently speeding, and when the jogger on the side of the road flies up over the car and flies onto the concrete behind the car, she, according to friends or someone, Tom, that she laughed or made some comment about what his body was doing in the air?
Yes. In the charging papers, the documents, we covered this story initially last week. That's what they said it was reported. I don't think there's any audio of her doing it.
No.
But that's what was reported, that she took kind of glee in hitting this person. Now she says, and I don't know that anyone's disputing this, that she didn't intend to kill him, but it's hard to hit somebody with a car and not have killing as a logical conclusion.
Right. So let's just make some assumptions that this person is not very bright. And then maybe they live in a world of watching movies where people hit people with cars and then road hog and they shake their fist and they drive or it's a video game where people's bodies fly in the air and then you just go on to the next sort of whatever it is you're trying to do on your video game. She's driving down the road. She's not, doesn't have a driver's license. She's speeding. She sees somebody and she figures, let's just hit the guy, having no idea of physics, not understanding anything. He dies in a ditch, right? Doesn't they, friend, and injuries?
Not reported. She reportedly stopped the car, got out, took a look at him, and then got back in the car and drove off.
Okay.
And then he died. So we don't know, but there's a possibility that if she had immediately called 911, that he might have survived the fact that she didn't do that. So it's not just that she hit him and maybe intentionally, it's also that it's a hit and run and she left and he ended up dying in that ditch.
So now the story is that they think she might have struck somebody else?
Yes. And they've released a picture a couple days earlier than this.
Mm-hmm.
Somebody, and again, there's some, it's a little unclear, but somebody might have been taking a video from inside the car that she was in, because we have a quick shot. It's kind of blurry, but a shot of somebody who looks youngish, I would guess. I mean, not like a kid, but like a young adult, wearing like a white T-shirt and a backpack.
Uh-huh.
And that person looks like they've been hit. Now, the police have checked and no one reported it. So we don't know if he was hit and, you know, killed and he's just lying somewhere in a ditch, or if he was so disoriented he never bothered reporting it. But that's it. Now looks like this might have been a serial hit and run killer.
So the last bit of news that I had heard is that I guess it's Reagan Dunn from King County Council would like to have a full investigation and possibly charge this minor with something other than adult.
Last week, there was a lot of discussion. Gene Ursula had the Casey McNerthy with the prosecutor's office, and they just said that, yeah, they do not have the capabilities of charging them as an adult, given the fact that she has no other record and this kind of stuff. But there was a lot of discussion last week, and this will just ramp that discussion up more to see if this could qualify as a teen prosecuted as an adult case. Yes.
Why? Because it's so egregious?
Yes, that's one. You know, so if it was intentional murder, if it was intentional murder, like I think that if you're a 15-year-old and you plot the death of somebody and then carry it out and intend to do it, then I think that would rise to the level of this is, I think, second degree murder.
All right. OK. Tracy Taylor's looking at traffic for us. Here we go. Thank you, Aaron. Keel Mortgage, 1-888-778-KIEL. That's right, Keel Mortgage, the best in the business when it comes to mortgage. Trust me, I know, I've experienced these other ones. Keel Mortgage, 1-888-778-KIEL. You buy that house of yours, make sure you go into the attic, unlike Dory, who's never been in his own attic. Is that not the weirdest thing?
I know.
You know,
it's scary.
You know, either you have a problem with steps, either your knees don't work, or you're so filthy rich. In the attic, I've never been into the attic before.
I'll have my butler check it out.
His attic. How's he never been to his attic?
I know.
Sometimes Dory spots him. Like, and Jacob's like, wow, following this is very interesting, this commercial. All righty, let's see. So finally it has happened. So as you know, Texas said, hey, we got this idea, that if soon as the fetal heart rate is detected, you cannot abort that child, and I think it's about 6 weeks normally. And if you do, then this is the strangest part. We, the state, we're not going to enforce this. Anybody that wants to can come along and sue you. So the first doctor, it seems like the, both of these people, the one guy that's decided to sue and the doctor that decided to come forward and say, by the way, I performed an abortion. I don't know how old the baby was, but the doctors come forward and now
first trimester,
but
post 6 weeks.
Okay. So then this person, two people are actually suing the doctor, right? Mm-hmm. And I don't know if anybody else, cause they said, oh, you could sue the Uber driver that drove the person. You could sue the nurse. You could sue this. So now the case is here it is. So now we get a chance to have the thing come forward. Who are the players, Tom?
So there, it's a doctor in, San Antonio, who says that he started doing this in 1972, even a year before the Roe versus Wade. And he says that in that year where that he started, he'd witnessed like three teens die of botched abortions when they try to do it themselves. He's an advocate of Roe versus Wade decision. And he didn't.
Who said this? The guy that's suing? Oh, the doctor. The doctor.
No, the San Antonio doctor who went public. His name is Alan Braid. He went public by writing a column in the Washington Post saying, yes, I'm a Texas doctor, and yes, I did this afterwards. Uh-huh. And so he explains why he did what he did. And This is all set up. I mean, so he's turning himself in.
Sure, sure.
He's saying, I did it over here. And this is designed to be taken to court and tested.
Mm-hmm.
So immediately there were two people that went after him from mm-hmm. different states, by the way. Somebody from Illinois and I forget who are the other. Arkansas and Illinois mm-hmm. filed lawsuits.
Yeah.
Now, interestingly enough, you might expect these to be anti-abortion activists. But instead, they're lawyers who I think just want to get the case heard.
Yeah,
because there are a lot of people that think that this Texas two-step is, you know, illegal and is unconstitutional. And so this is a way to demonstrate that. And we'll have to see as it plays itself out in court. But very interesting decisions on both parts. First, for the doctor to self-confess, and then for the court case to be held about whether what Texas is doing is valid or not.
The one guy that did, I think the first one I'd read about in the Wall Street Journal, the one that filed first, I think, he says he's neither pro-life nor pro-abortion. He just sort of, and I think at home because he's under house confinement or something because some fraudulent something or other.
He's a former lawyer who lost his law license after being convicted of tax fraud in 2010.
Okay. All right.
And so that's interesting. You have more information either. This just says he's not opposed to abortion.
Yeah.
But sued to force a court review of this law because he thinks the law seems to be an end run.
And he also said if somebody's going to get $10,000, why can't it be me?
Did he say that?
That's in the Wall Street Journal.
Yeah. Oh, he did? Yeah. Okay, that's good. And the other guy who sued
Tommy needs the money. He's out of work. He's lost his license from tax fraud. Well, by the way, when he gets the $10,000, he's going to now pay the taxes on it, too. He also said that.
Okay,
no,
well,
didn't.
Then
no,
the other guy. Isn't it wonderful when you've read something that I haven't, so you can
Wall
throw
Street
out
Journal,
anything,
yeah,
and I can't check
that.
It. Yeah. But the other guy, though, says that he's more selfless, shall we say. Mm. He says that if he happened to win the $10,000, I'm assuming he's hoping he loses it, but that he would turn it over to an abortion rights group or maybe the patients of the doctor that he sued. So
yeah.
So there are going to be a lot of cases coming down the pike. Now, we've already mentioned in the past, the Supreme Court has decided to hear the Mississippi case, mm-hmm. which at the time was seen as really extreme, and now that's nothing compared to the Texas law, but that is seen as a chance to overturn Roe versus Wade,
yeah.
Given the makeup of the Supreme Court. But along this track, the challenge to the Texas law is that really legitimate? What they're doing, saying that, hey, you can't sue the state because the state's not enforcing
it.
A lot of Republicans, I watched the Wall Street Journal, the Journal Report, the TV show mm-hmm. every weekend, and even they, although they are, pro or anti, let's say their anti-abortion position, they were queasy on this Texas law because they think this means that anybody can establish this, that the government can do anything, and as long as they claim, oh, it's up to private citizens, that they were themselves uncomfortable with that and suspect that not that many, maybe Utah, but not that many states will follow up on it. But we'll have to see if
that allowance is
given. Yes, it's
very
clever.
When
maybe
this
clever
thing
by
first happened, we
too
see,
much.
Yeah, when this first happened, we thought, this is interesting. They're saying, so you're not going to be able sue the state, you're going to have to go after the individuals. And as you pointed out, the question is standing. Do you have standing? Now, I'm sure when they come up with this clever idea, they must have some way that the person can claim standing and claim harm in order to be able to file this case. Because they wouldn't put this whole thing together and go, oh, gosh, we forgot about standing and damages. Forgot about damage. Of course they're going to have that part of it worked out. I was reading an interesting piece today.
I wonder.
So much in science has changed from 1974. So 74 viability was 22 weeks, right? 1974, 22 weeks is viable. Now,
24, I think.
24 weeks.
Yeah.
Now, a doctor can do a fetal operation. The first fetal operation was 1984. That they make an incision, remove the fetus, perform the operation on the fetus and put the fetus back in, and then that was the first one, 1984, and the baby goes to full term and whatever they corrected while in the womb. The advances that have been made in science would point to, then do we start to change our behavior? Is the idea the Supreme Court said, well, the baby is not viable, doesn't feel pain. Well, the interesting thing is when they do these operations on these babies, they have an anesthesiologist standing by. And the reason they do is the baby is 16 weeks old or 20 weeks old or even younger than that. And the anesthesiologist is keeping the child anesthetized, the baby, because it feels pain. So as we learn more about science, do you start start to move that number from 24 weeks of viability, because now we know that a kid can live outside the womb. I mean, it's amazing, right? They're the size of a Coke can, and they're able to survive, because that's not deep 1974 medicine. We've moved way beyond that, and maybe you make some adjustments, or maybe you kick it back to the states and let them decide whether you want to have abortion or no abortions, right?
Well, the Supreme Court's going to decide a lot of those issues. And, yeah, the question is the determination, because, in effect, it was kind of a Solomonic decision.
Yeah.
They didn't grant abortion rights all the way up to the moment of giving birth. They decided they kind of, you know, split the difference and said, you know, up to when a fetus can survive outside the womb. And, yeah, I would guess that maybe not now, you know, but maybe within 50 years, that survival outside the womb would be sooner than 24 weeks. And then it becomes an issue of...
It is now.
It's, well, not significantly, I don't think.
Well, one life or a million, right? I mean, it's still significant. How much you need for significant?
Well, the thing is, it can survive outside the womb. I don't know what constitutes that, how they determine that 24 weeks. But, yes, so let's say it's 22 weeks
or
21 weeks.
Uh-huh.
The thing is that are you shading it based on some kind of medical testimony from what hospitals can do or cannot? And that number may come down, mm-hmm. which may mean that is no longer a valid if you're arguing for a woman has a right over her body. And a lot of women, I don't know, and I'm not saying a majority, but some women think that you should. It's up to her to decide all the way up till giving birth. That's not what the Supreme Court decided. And we'll have to see how viable that is.
Tracy Taylor's looking at traffic for us. Here we go. The 24-hour culture, Tom, of dining in Seattle is slowly, well, it's hoping to come back. I know Beth's Cafe, which was 24 hours, and it was the home of like the 50-egg omelet or something like that.
Yeah, 12,
and then used to be able to go. 13 Coins was 24 hours.
Yeah.
There would be like a nightlife. And then afterwards, you want to go soak up some of the booze or whatever. So you'd go to some place at 3 o'clock in the morning and be hanging around and 13 Coins had that kind of feeling. It always felt like it was 2 in the morning when you were in there.
Right.
It was so dark.
It was so dark. I know. It could be 3 in the afternoon on a bright, sunny day.
Hey, let's go somewhere it feels like it's 1 in the morning. Let's go to 13 Coins. So this is, in some places, it's trying to come back. I think there's a Denny's somewhere and out near Tukwila. That's about it.
Yeah, the only restaurant, 24/7 restaurant in Seattle these days is IHOP. And I assume the only IHOP I know that's still around is the one, you know, near Seattle University on Madison there. Mm-hmm. So I think that's near Capitol Hill. But yeah, all the Beth's Cafe is just completely shut down. The North Star Diner, which it's been there, you know, for the last few years, it's not like an old timer like a mm-hmm. Beth's Cafe, in my neighborhood of Greenwood. That's a 24/7, someplace called Lost Lake up on Capitol Hill. And they mentioned 13 Coins, but they've all restricted their nighttime. So they're closing at 12 or at 1 at night. And it's the impact of the pandemic. They don't have enough staff and or customers to support it. And so this is kind of an article written about, you know, kind of how much we miss or what do we miss when we don't have these kinds of places? Because it really only appeals to a small subset of people that are up late. In fact, I remember, in the early days when I used to work on movie reviews, at night at the station, Steph and Ed, Steph, who now runs MyNorthwest.com, and mm-hmm. Ed, who was the night editor, the three of us would all go out to eat when our shifts got over at 2 o'clock in the morning. We would mm-hmm. all go out to eat.
Yeah.
There's something really special about those kind of times because you realize that 99% of the world is shut down and you are still exhibiting that. And this is kind of a nostalgic appeal to this kind of diner and the hopes that post-COVID it will come back. And the question is, like a lot of stuff, will COVID, will the lockdown, will everything else have impacted it so much that people will be out of the habit and will no longer return?
Yeah, and as you say, it is a particular part of the population that goes to these things. Whether it was truckers, that there's a place in Cle Elum that doesn't do 24 hours anymore, Cottage Cafe. Have great hamburgers and stuff, but the problem is you have to pay somebody a lot of money to hang around when you only have 6 or 7 customers coming in. So the cost is just too great. And then the other part was, like, in Seattle, who's out there partying and then going to 13 Coins?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, the nightlife is mostly shut down as well. So the post-nightlife hanging out at the 24-hour cafe. And it's even inflicting itself in Paris. There's a famous Opie de Cochon 24-7 place that Paige and I love to go to. And it closes at midnight now. So it's happening worldwide, not just here in Seattle.
The movie Barry Levinson's Diner. Were they open? Were they staying open late in that one? They were in Baltimore, right?
Yeah, it was in Baltimore. That's a good question. I can't remember now. Late night scenes. They were always at night. I mean, they would gather, but I can't remember now if it was 24/7 or not.
Great,
probably.
Great movie.
Yes,
Mickey Rourke was in that.
Yes, he was. Yeah. Before he became Mickey Rourke.
That's true. Let's see. Tracy Taylor has some bad news for anybody. It feels like you're a bit of 24-hour diner as you sit in traffic that long.